Mia neighborhood of Baghdad, which is a real sort of hotspot for anti-American insurgents. It's a neighborhood which is the home to a lot of Saddam's apparatchiks, if you want to call them that, folks that were involved in the Ba'athist regime, government officials. I traveled north of Baghdad to villages around Tikrit, Al-Auja, which is Saddam's hometown, and which is one of two cities in Iraq that are fully enclosed by barbed wire with a single entry point going in and out, guarded by U.S. Army and National Guard. Samarra, which is another city, which is a real hotspot for anti-American resistance. I spent time to the west of Baghdad in Ramadi, which probably, you know, I think you could say is the western border of the Sunni triangle, Tikrit being the border to the north.
How obvious is it when, for example, you cross, let's say, from a non-Ba'athist part, maybe a Shia part of Baghdad, or from one town to the next, and you're how much is the distinction visible on the street when you go into these Ba'athist neighborhoods?
Well, I think, you know, I would say, start off by saying that the insurgency is not a monolithic group. There's elements of the insurgency that are pro-Ba'athist, pro-Saddam loyalists. I would say many in the Al-Adamiyah neighborhood of Baghdad, certainly some in other towns such as Fallujah, Ramadi. But there's, I think, increasingly more elements of the insurgency and sort of the above-ground political opposition in Iraq that are simply Iraqis of all religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, who have just had enough of the occupation. That includes Sunnis, that includes Shia. So I don't know that it's more of like a visual difference. Certainly in Baghdad, you have neighborhoods such as Sadr City, which is a sprawling slum of 2 to 3 million Shia who got nothing under Saddam, and many of whom I think did not necessarily support the invasion last year, but because of the history of repression under Saddam, were certainly willing to give the Americans a chance. And many Shia, rank-and-file Shia, whatever you want to call them, just folks that you walk up to on the street or in the cafe, you know, told me, you know, repression under Saddam was really extreme. The Americans came, and we really hoped that they would remove Saddam. However, now that they removed Saddam, they should just move on. Let us get back to rebuilding our country. However, they haven't done that. And the situation in Iraq has deteriorated to such an extent where there's sporadic electricity a year after the invasion. There's still long gas lines. They were rationing gasoline when I was there. There's random shootings from military convoys. There's an unelected government. You have essentially a dictatorship. You have all the worst aspects of Saddam's regime, plus total social collapse. People have had enough, and that's another part of the resistance. And then there's certainly speculation about outside nationals coming in from, would they be Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria?
Have you noticed this? I mean, or
no.
Have you met any? No.
No. And I would certainly say that anything that the U.S. administration and the military in Iraq says should be certainly looked at with skepticism. And last time I checked, we shouldn't believe anything these guys say. I think one thing that the U.S. military constantly brings up is this letter that they intercepted, quote-unquote, from this operative in Fallujah, Zarqawi.
Oh, I didn't know. So Zarqawi was also in Fallujah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this city seems to be very, or maybe right now because of the media portrayal, it's being highlighted and I'm being affected by that. But it seems like there have been increasing attacks. 15 soldiers, helicopters shot down,
yeah,
over and over, and these big attacks, they went to the prison and released the prisoners.
Yeah.
So it's this huge hotbed of resistance.
Well, I think to call Fallujah and some of these other cities in the Sunni Triangle hotbeds of resistance is really like an understatement. I mean, Fallujah is a town that, while the 82nd Airborne, which was patrolling, which was ostensibly responsible for policing and rebuilding, quote unquote, Fallujah, the 82nd Airborne never entered Fallujah unless they were doing an operation. They did not do patrols. They would only go in if they had what they thought was credible intelligence on insurgents, their whereabouts, and or arms caches that could be seized. Because every time the 82nd Airborne entered Fallujah, they would come under attack within half an hour. This is what soldiers said. Therefore, they did not go in all that often. And when they did, they almost always came under attack within half an hour, an hour. They would come under RPG attacks. They would never go in with less than, you know, three platoons of soldiers, about 300 soldiers. So what I think some of the spike, if you want to call it that, in Fallujah recently, I think signals that the Marine Expeditionary Unit that is operating now has taken a very different strategy, which is instead of treating Fallujah as an epicenter for resistance, therefore we're not going to engage it. Marines are going in and trying to do as much. They're patrolling again, and I think that's what some of these attacks are.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I think they're going to come down pretty hard. I'm looking at the New York Times at page 8 right now, and I'm going to read you a few paragraphs just to hint at what's coming. They're saying a senior military official said that American forces in Iraq were already planning and, quote, appropriate response, unquote, to the grisly killings and overall violence in Fallujah. We're not getting panicky over this, the senior official said. In Iraq, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, Deputy Operations Director for the Occupation Forces, said, we will respond. It's going to be deliberate, it will be precise, and it will be overwhelming. He added, we will pacify Fallujah.
Right. Well, what this is, I mean, this is...
Is this a bombing?
Yeah, campaign? I think this is... This is clearly going to be a collective punishment in Fallujah that is yet unseen.
Collective punishment for what? For video footage of? I think that's very important that we're not realizing that the reason why this is really a huge kind of people are talking about like all political equations changing because of this one event where four people died, right?
Yeah.
They're talking about like soldiers being withdrawn. This is one, four people dying, but it's also these images of dead charcoal bodies hanging from the bridge, which
right.
I think, so basically there's going to be this bombing campaign because of images or a collective punishment because of images.
Right. Well, I think we should discuss actually what these images mean, how the media has responded to this incident of four quote unquote civilians being their bodies being killed, their bodies being mutilated and hung from a bridge in Fallujah. We should talk about that. But I think first, just getting to what you just read, Fallujah and most cities in the Sunni Triangle where there's resistance have undergone a collective punishment since day one of the invasion. Not much less 12 years of sanctions under the UN led by the Americans. However, since last year, these are towns which you go to and people in Fallujah, Ramadi, Samarra will talk about not having electricity for 3 weeks, water being cut off for all but 1 or 2 hours per day. F-16s flying low altitude, flying at a very low altitude throughout the entire night. You know, it's psychological terror on top of a collective punishment, which is essentially trying to squeeze this area of the country into submission. And I'll say this, the Israeli economy may be doing terribly, but one thing they're definitely exporting is counterinsurgency methods. And I think you know, not that I want to help the American occupation out at all, but you would think that they would, if they're going to use Israeli counterinsurgency methods, that they're going to look to the situation in the West Bank and Gaza and see that these methods do not, you know, repress opposition. In fact, you know, Palestinians have been fighting for decades, and they're fighting just as intensely for their way of life, for you know, and to essentially achieve a nation state. And there's no indication that Iraq will not be the exact same situation.
All right, so we're going to take a musical break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk more about the power of these images and other things, and also the connection between collective punishment and this connection between Palestine and the situation in Iraq and occupation in general. Let me see what we have on our playlist. All right, we're going to play a song from Nico. I guess we're going with the Velvet Underground years right now. It's going to be Chelsea Girls from the same CD, Chelsea Girls.
Here's room 546. It's enough to make you sick. Bridget's all wrapped up in foil. You wonder if she can uncoil. Here they come now. See them run now. Here they come now. Chelsea girls. Here's room 115. Filled with S&M queens, magic marker, oh, you wonder just how high they go. Here they come now, see them run now. Here they come now. Chelsea girls. Here's Pope dear on Dean. Ronis treated him so mean. She wants another scene. She wants to be a human being. Here they come now, see them run now. Here they come now, Chelsea girls. Pepe, she's having fun. She thinks she's some man's son. Her perfect loves don't last, her future died in someone's past. Here they come now, see them run now. Here they come now, Chelsea girls. Thank you. on her lick. She's turned another trick. Her treats and times revolve. She's got problems to be solved. Here they come now. See them run now. Here they come now. Chelsea girls. For Mary, she's uptight. She can turn out her light. She wrote Susan in a ball, and now she can't see her at all. Here they come now. See them run now. Here they come now. Chelsea girl. Drop out, she's in a fix. Amphetamine has made her sick. White powder in the air. She's got no bones and can be scared. Here they come now. See them run now. Chelsea girl. Here comes Johnny Ball. He collapsed on the floor. They shut him up with milk, and when he died, so impossible.
So we had a request from the Peanut Gallery, from the Indie Bay Peanut Gallery, to not play any more Nico. So there, no more Nico. Okay,
I agree.
All right, I guess I mean maybe. Well, what we're gonna play next actually Rob brought, so. Maybe, I don't know, it's probably going to be really good. What are we going to hear next?
I don't know if it'd be really good. Well, I suggested, I picked up a new CD, Brigitte Fontaine, who's a sort of French pop singer from 60s and 70s and Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Nice. But before that, of course, we're going to go more in depth, and Liam is going to, Liam just walked into the studio like 10 minutes ago during the middle of the show. And he works for the Bay Guardian and is a volunteer with Indie Bay as well.
Good to be here. I was just wondering about you know, the incredible American and global response to the images that Ali was just mentioning, you know, of the burnt bodies. I think one of the things that's got people so, you know, upset is not only the images of the bodies, but also, and maybe even more so, the cheering crowd. You know, people are scared. You know, is this what Iraqis really think of Americans, is what they think of our efforts? And I was just wondering if you know, you noticed that kind of, you know, hatred and antipathy towards the Americans and the, you know, security forces when you were over there in Iraq.
Yeah, well, I think let me take the second part of the question first, which is, you know, when these things happen, there's an incredible outpouring of support for let me think about this. I mean, when I was in some of the areas in the Sunni Triangle, people, the collective punishment that was going on in towns and small villages in the Sunni Triangle clearly meant that. It was very hard for me to find anybody that had anything good to say about the U.S. presence in Iraq. when people spoke of soldiers being killed in Baghdad or Tikrit or, you know, Fallujah, they spoke about it with a great sense, not everyone, but certainly many people I spoke to talked about it with a great sense of pride. And by and large, people spoke about it in terms of, this is what they get. Didn't they know that when they were going to occupy our country and not leave, that they would be met with resistance? Even people that were supportive initially, like I was saying before, there were people that were brutalized and repressed severely under Saddam and who welcomed the American occupation. And that certainly challenged my sort of opposition to the war. Even those people said, the Americans have to go. And if they don't go, we're going to send them out by force. And so I think when, you know, you're right, the American public, I think, is at one hand presented with these images, these very, very harsh images of bodies being hung from a bridge over the Euphrates in Fallujah. And they're also presented with this reality that people in Iraq do not want the Americans there. And I think the blame for that is, I think, the mainstream media, which has not looked at this occupation as critically as they should. And this is not a newsflash. I mean, let's be honest. There's 580 dead soldiers that the U.S. military, the Defense Department, has confirmed. There's countless soldiers who are horribly maimed and injured, laying in hospital beds in military hospitals in Europe and America. And there's countless numbers of private security that have also been killed and injured.
I mean, just to play the devil's advocate here, though, I mean, if we pulled out unilaterally tomorrow, you know, we went there to get rid of a tyrant. If we just pulled all our force out, wouldn't that be opening the door for, you know, the someone else with just as much power, possibly someone just as ruthless as Saddam, to take over? I mean, we're trying to get rid of the dictators. Do you think they're ready for, does the current Iraqi government have the, you know, stability to transition to democracy yet?
No, well, I mean, the current Iraqi government's a hand-picked American council of Iraqi exiles who had little or no support in Iraq.
Not to mention that they're all scumbags, basically, who are wanted for...
How do you really feel?
For laundering Jordanian money.
Yeah.
You know, these people, they're wanted in Jordan. The Chalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress, who is basically the key player in this interim government formation, and for years fed by the United States, and money was... There were congressional investigations into the Iraqi National Congress, and the aid was cut off at one point because they realized how this money was being spent on various luxury residences in London and so forth. Yeah. But,
you know, I think we've got to look at the question of sectarian violence in Iraq. And I think that who really benefits by the potential of sectarian violence? It's the American occupation. It's Ahmed Chalabi. It's the Iraqi Governing Council, who were not democratically elected. And so this perception of a potential Balkanization, call it whatever you want, in Iraq means that, oh, we have to tread lightly, we have to take things carefully. In just interviews that I did in Iraq, cold interviews, walking into a cafe in both Sunni and Shia neighborhoods, people identified as Iraqi. They were like, look, we want the U.S. occupation to end, and we want to move on with an elected government, move on with our own democracy. So I think the potential for civil war in Iraq is really overplayed. Do I think that it takes only a small minority to set off a civil war? Yes, that's always a potential. But I think it's really overplayed to legitimize this presence. Now, there's tensions between Kurds and Arabs, I think, that certainly, I think, has the potential for being very, very... lead to some serious violence in an ongoing conflict. But I think
that's the conflict that the U.S. never recognizes.
Right.
they're all about the inter-Arab conflict. You know?
Right. So I don't know if that I forgot the first part of your question though.
So I mean, would you be for a unilateral removal of U.S. forces tomorrow, or do you think that would just destabilize the region too much? What's your solution for, you know, the quagmire that the United States has got itself into at this point?
Well, I mean, I think the short answer is it's not my position to say. I'm not Iraqi. I don't live there. I visited there for 5 weeks. I'm a journalist. I went there to investigate counterinsurgency methods and to talk to, and I also looked at this question of sectarian violence. You know, I don't have the answer. I think the answer should be posed to Iraqis. And I think that many forums are available for that, in terms of, you know, an Iraqi press, Iraqi social movements are developing. You know, there's many other people that are better equipped, better informed to answer that question.
And also, I mean, there's a huge difference, in my opinion, between a U.S. military occupation of a country. And some sort of a police force. You know, right. There's a difference between an army and a police. As much as I despise pigs, I still think that there is a difference between an army and a police.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that what we have to look at is that this notion that that Iraq is this is just completely chaos, insane, out of control. You know,
yeah.
This representation of the place. And when we look at why this has been caused, I mean, we have to go back to the origins of this. We're talking about a geographical region of the world where basically civilization started from. This is where writing came from, urban lifestyle, everything that practically has led to what the United States is trying or saying that it's advancing in. Modern technology, etc., is originating from the Mesopotamian region. So, and then we have to realize when this transition happened of this place as a cultural center, as a artistic, a thriving economy, even under Saddam, you know, even under this horrible, brutal dictator, there was the most people would travel to Iraq for its healthcare, for example, but. When you look at what started to happen in the beginning of the century and onward, you see that the destruction of this civilization and this self-sustaining society, and this destruction is not coming from within, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a complete imperialist operation spanning many different empires, you know,
mm-hmm.
onto this one region. And, I mean, I think that people have to realize I think it's easy to get caught up in specifics, you know. Do they leave now, today, or like the next week? Like what happens then? Like which sects attack the other sects? But we have to look at the bigger picture of how do we restore this. I'm kind of getting caught up in my thoughts, but how do we stop imposing? Our will on this region.
Let me put it to you this way. I would ask, when I was in Iraq, I would ask that question to Iraqis. And I'd say, well, what do you envision for the future of Iraq? And many times I got the answer of, well, we'll deal with that once the occupation is over. The immediate goal was an end to U.S. occupation of Iraq. And then can we move on to really discuss, you know, what's going to happen? And, I, you know, just to make a comparison, I think, you know, when the anti-globalization movement criticizes capitalism, criticizes the WTO and the IMF, and they're always presented with the question of, well, how do you see global trade working? How do you see, you know, people maintaining the jobs that they have? And it's just like, look, you know, we didn't choose to be in an opposition, an oppositional position. You put us there, speaking of global capital, by imposing these policies. You know, in Iraq, I think is, you know, that's a good analogy for Iraq, which is, look, I don't want it, as somebody opposes the war in Iraq and somebody who went to Iraq and saw what was going on, I don't want to be put in the position where I'm asked, how do I want to see Iraq governed? Okay, that's not why, you know, I went there. It's not why I opposed the war. I think Iraqis, people in Iraq, you know, and that meaning everybody from Kurdistan down to the south who, you know, are largely Shia. I mean, it's up to them. I mean, I believe in self-determination. I believe in it should be recognized that that's their choice.
Even if they want to instill some kind of strict Islamic government similar to the Taliban, where, you know, women can still be punished by, you know, stoning to death for, you know, infidelity and, you know, denying education to women and things like that. I mean, that's self-determined, right? That could be, you know, self-determination right there. But then you get into the question of human rights. You know, how do you, you know, resolve that conflict between, you know, certain aspects of the Islamic religion and the more basic fundamental question of equality?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's a great question. And you know what? I don't think that there will be or there would be an Islamic state in Iraq. I think even in the South, where there's a lot of cultural ties to Iran and there's a lot of support for conservative, fundamentalist, whatever, Islamic clerics, I don't think there would be. I don't think if Iraqis voted for a government now, it would lead to an Islamic state. I believe that most Iraqis really, truly, I mean, Iraq over the last, you know, number of decades was a secular state. It was a place where people practiced religion. The Shia were incredibly repressed under Saddam, but to a certain extent, you know, they have, you know, there were Shia and Sunni mosques. I don't see Iraq turning into a religious, I don't see it turning to Sharia law, the strict interpretation of the Quran. In fact, I would say that the American occupation has ushered in Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, under Saddam, I mean, this is one of the ironies. Under Saddam, people, you know, I spoke to women. I spoke to women in Baghdad who would say, I went out with friends till 2 or 3 in the morning. We would be at cafes all night. We'd go out dancing. We'd listen to music. We'd go see films. There was never any fear of what is happening now, which is there's rape gangs, there's kidnappings. There's women who no longer feel it's safe to go out without the hijab. And I would say, in fact, that secular state has turned into a place where Islamic fundamentalism has really been able to flourish because of this political vacuum.
I know one of the worries was that, you know, with the destabilization in Iraq, you know, some of the jihadists and Islamic fundamentalists were going to, you know, pour in from other regions to try to, like, foment, you know, conservative revolution. When you were there, did you get any feeling of how open the borders were? Or, like, if there were people, you know, coming in from other regions?
The borders are wide open.
What border?
Every border. I mean, I can imagine, the borders are wide open. Syria, the border with Jordan, Iran. I mean, there's obvious. I do believe that there's outside nationals coming in and assisting with certain sectors of the insurgency.
Did you go through a border checkpoint when you went in?
I went through a border checkpoint, yes. But I don't know that. I mean, look, the American military has 130,000 troops in Iraq. And they are largely occupied in the Sunni triangle.
Do you know what percentage? That's interesting. I wonder. It'd be interesting to see some sort of map where you could see the population of the army in each region.
I mean, that 130,000, those 130,000 American troops are largely in the Sunni triangle.
Wow.
There's some in the north. The south,
at least in the north, probably, huh?
Yeah, the south is primarily British troops, there's some Spanish, the Polish troops are down there. But the American troops are largely tied up trying to hold down whatever semblance of normality they can in the Sunni triangle. I mean, border patrolling is just like third or fourth on their list, and they can't even handle number one on their list, which is securing central Iraq.
All right, let's play a track, and then we're going to talk a bit more. What do you have a particular one that I should play off of this CD?
Just 7, 8, 9. I don't know.
All right. All right. What's your favorite? And also, I'm just going to give out our number once again. Please call in. It's 415-864-1006, and we can add you into the discussion and hear from you. So this is Bridget Fontaine and the
Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Art Ensemble in Chicago. Track 7.
Mon mari a été exécuté ce matin. J'ai pris ça très mal. Question : qu'est devenu mon sens de l'humour ?
You're back with Turkish Delight. This week's program, we have Rob Eshelman, recently back from Iraq, and Liam here from the Bay Guardian. And we're talking about the recent hysteria and emphasis put on Fallujah in the media, and actually what's happening on the ground in Iraq. And I want to read this. I found this small section in the article on the front page of the New York Times today, and then we're going to go into another discussion about the imagery after that. But before, it says, but some of the same people said they felt embarrassment when mobs tore the bodies apart afterward and dragged them through the streets, turning this town in the heart of the Sunni triangle not into a symbol not only of resistance but of barbarity. So basically, I mean, if we were going to use a similar equation, then we should also say that Washington, D.C. can definitely be a symbol of barbarity in the 21st century. But of course, you'll never read that on the front page of the New York Times. But to go back to the imagery that we were talking about, here it says, the images beamed, Iraqi television crews caught the end of the mayhem. The images beamed worldwide were reminiscent of scenes from Somalia in 1993, when a mob dragged the body of an American soldier through the streets of Mogadishu. And in fact, the incident that happened in Fallujah, there was also a dragging of a charred body tied to the back of a car. So these images, we scarcely see images of bombed children on the front page of the New York Times. And therefore, the barbarity is always one-sided. What do you think about this comparison with what happened in 93 in Somalia?
Well, I think the thing to start with is that that immediately the hawks, you know, the boosters for the war in Iraq, immediately came out and said, I think, you know, this is not Somalia. These images are different. This is not thousands of Somali people celebrating, you know, downed helicopters in the middle of Mogadishu. This is like a few scattered residents of Fallujah who were scared, who didn't like this. Is, you know, these are small cells of insurgents. This is like disgruntled Iraqis. This is no big deal. When in fact, this is really, I think, representative of a ongoing and what has been a very consistent opposition in Iraq to the occupation. And I think, again, this is the media basically catching up with the reality that they've tried very long and very hard to ignore, which is that popular support in Iraq for the American occupation is very slim. But I think in terms of the images and the language that the mainstream media in America has used, is they call it barbaric, they call it horrific. You know, they put the images on the front page of, you know, the San Francisco Chronicle or USA Today of these, you know, bodies dangling from these bridges. Yet when the bombing happened a year ago, or even now, if you go to Iraq, and there's children that are maimed from cluster bombs, unexploded ordnances that are lying in fields in Baghdad and all over the country. I mean, that is truly horrific. But you do not see that on the front page of the New York Times. You know, last week when that 14-year-old boy went to the checkpoint outside of Gaza.
In fact, last week I talked about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just like never, ever have I seen so many photos on the front page of the New York Times. You would think, like, not even during, I don't know, as I remember, not even during 9/11.
No.
Did they have that many photos, color photos, on the front page of the New York Times? You would think the world was collapsing because this 14-year-old boy was caught at a checkpoint in Gaza. Just as now you see these images on the front page of the New York Times about these civilians, which is another issue. These are not civilians. These are mercenaries.
And on the right? on the front page of the New York Times, you can see a picture of one of these mercenaries, Blackwater, USA.
Blackwater, which is one of the things that I want to cover next, is in May, they're having a SWAT team tournament at Blackwater's ranch in North Carolina.
You gotta be kidding
me. And it's going to be covered by ESPN.
You gotta be kidding me.
I'm serious.
Paintball guns or what?
Yeah, it's like a SWAT team all-star match.
And it's all ex-SWAT or real SWAT.
Real SWAT teams that are trained by Blackwater throughout the country, you know, Reno, you know, Detroit, wherever. And they're all going as teams and they're competing against each other.
And the winner gets to go to Baghdad.
No, I think the winner, you know, the winner gets to go to Baghdad, right. But, you know, I think, you know, the largest military presence in Iraq is the United States military. 130,000 troops, over 130,000 troops. The next largest is private contractors.
What's the ratio again in the Gulf War? Was one in 100, and now it's 1 in 10 soldiers are actually hired.
I don't know.
I think it's a tenfold increase.
Yeah.
Between 10 years and now.
Yeah, and you know it that's not lost on Iraqis in Fallujah. They realize that that these SUVs filled with flak jacketed submachine gun wielding civilians are not civilians per se, but indeed part of a military force. And the U.S. military has outsourced security, has outsourced a lot of intelligence. I mean, that's one question that that hasn't been answered. What the heck were these dudes doing in Fallujah?
This is a huge.
Washington Post said, they were guarding food deploy.
When did the military get privatized? You know, like I think I missed when that happened, but it's definitely a reality in the bombing campaigns in Kosovo.
They're overextended.
Yeah,
and that you know, quite a few of these private contractors are, you know, employees of the Bechtel Corporation, and this is a really big deal because instead of the United States saying, you know, oh, we have, you know, just throwing out some crazy number out here, 10,000 troops, you know, we can have 10,000 people over there, but only 1,000 actual troops, and the other 9,000 are contractors, so we get to, you know, give these figures out to the American public that are really unrealistic because, in essence, you know, we're completely paying for it, but just because they're not actual members of the military, you know, it's kind of washing the blood off the U.S. government's hands.
Also, I mean, I guess I don't want to say ideal, but in an ideal capitalist world, the army does not have. I don't know. Ideal is hard to define right now. But you're removing. I think more than the numbers game, what's important is that you're removing the military personnel from some sort of control or legal judiciary system. You know, because supposedly the U.S. Army answers to the president or the Congress or some sort of public office, whereas these private contractors, they only answer to profit motive, you know. So if there's money being made killing and slaughtering innocent people, then there's going to be a very, very little it's going to be very easy to do that once it's deemed profitable. I think that's the biggest problem, in my opinion.
Well, the foreign minister in England, you know, recently came out and said, look, we've got a serious problem. You know, our special forces units, part of the British military, are quitting and becoming private contractors. You know, providing security for, you know, the BBC. I don't know if they're providing security for the BBC, but they're becoming private contractors in Iraq. You know, and certainly on an individual level, that SAS guy who's patrolling, I don't know, Northern Ireland or wherever, although their presence seems kind of diminished these past few years, but who knows, they'll get back there soon. I mean, they're saying, hey, it's a great career move to go to Iraq. You know, as far as, like, you know, they're taking over responsibility for the military, it shows that the ideological goals of this very small cabal within the U.S. administration, the White House, the Defense Department, has overextended the real reach of the American military. And they have no choice, from their perspective, to go to the private market. And in fact, it's sort of high costs in a way. I mean, to send another 100,000 troops to Iraq, which isn't possible just because those troops don't exist.
Well, there could be a draft. I mean,
I don't think that would be socially acceptable.
But I mean, this here's is the way of but avoiding here's the point. That here's the point. Firestorm.
Right, it's a way of avoiding the political firestorm, and it's a way to hide the costs because these contracts are given out at a cost plus basis, which means you get $1 million, but you can charge up to 10% over that cost, and they can just bill. And that's what Bechtel and Halliburton are doing. Bechtel was going to hire, I think, 6 security people. They went into Iraq thinking, we're going to hire 6 security people. In fact, now they're hiring 169.
I mean, I'm really, I understand the political implications of this, of private contractors in terms of U.S. politics, in terms of, the representation of numbers and how they're playing the media game. But really, for me, what is more concerning is the effect that these private contractors are going to have upon the civilian population of Iraq. I mean, I don't think it's a very far-fetched imagination to see that maybe in 3 years, these, you just said 160 what? So these corporations are going to have small armies,
mm-hmm.
in around their respective factories. And this is basically another kind of sovereign force within Iraq trying to control the resources, trying to suppress protest, trying to conduct operations in neighborhoods because people have been bombing their factories. I mean, it's just such a fuck up in terms of what they're doing to that country to bring in these extra forces that have absolutely no accountability apart from answering to the dollar. Right. I don't know.
You were over in Iraq. Can you tell us about your personal observations about, the relations between the private contractors, just milling around in general society as opposed to the, the actual armed forces over there, just dealing, you see people in the cafes or whatever walking around the streets. How are their attitudes different? How do they carry themselves differently? Are they as respected? I mean, do you want to go into that?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is members of the U.S. military, contractors, private security do not mill about. They just do not interact with Iraqis on a regular basis.
Because they get shot.
They get killed, that's to be expected in many ways. The Iraqis view, I think rightfully so, that contractors and security are part of the American occupation. I mean, these 4 civilians, quote-unquote, as far as I'm concerned, they were they're actors in the American occupation. They're soldiers. They were doing intelligence. They were doing whatever they were doing in Fallujah. And they were just as much as the military, just as much part of the military occupation as any soldier, as far as I'm concerned. The Iraqis treated them as such, just as the American military treats any person in a camp in, southeastern Afghanistan, they're an enemy combatant. The Iraqis have essentially adopted America's view towards irregular soldiers.
Where does the mainstream media fall into that? Because a lot of these, news teams are driving around SUVs and they're carrying weapons and bodyguards now too, and they know that, the Iraqis know that these people are basically, some of these bandits are out there looking for resources. They have the media has money, they have guns, they're willing to defend themselves. Do you think that the media getting involved in some more of these fights? I know more and more media teams are actually arming themselves now. Do you think that's a detriment?
Well, I do think it's a detriment. One, as a journalist, I think as a journalist, you're trying to form human relationships with people, understand where they're coming from, what their situation is. If you're wearing a bulletproof vest and have a gun, you don't develop a human relationship with somebody.
And also, if you're staying in the American compound, you don't really.
And the other thing is, just as much as the American military and contractors don't interact with Iraqis, neither does the mainstream media. I mean, a lot of what I call the you know, A-team of the American media, international media, you know, CNN, ABC. These people stay in the Palestine and Sheraton hotels, which are, you've got two checkpoints just to get into those hotels. There's a perimeter set up, which is like, you know, 12-foot-high blast barriers, contract blast barriers. They're impenetrable in a lot of ways. Although, you know, they seem to get hit with RPGs pretty often. But, you know, this is, and if you turn on the TV, if you turn on ABC News, the image you always see when somebody's reporting from Iraq is a blue mosque in the background. These people are filming from their hotel room. They put a spotlight on this mosque, which is across the street from the Sheraton and Palestine hotels, and that's where they air from. And they rarely get out. When they get, and a lot of the footage is file footage, when they do actually go out, they send Iraqi freelance journalists. They send fixers to go out and do interviews because they're scared.
That was one. And the rest of it is just U.S. Government press releases, huh?
Yeah. Well, and when you're in your hotel, where are you going to get your stories generated from? You're going to get they're going to be generated from Dan Senor, General Kimmett. You know, I mean, if you pick up the Washington Post, the New York Times, a lot of it is, you know, leads with General Kimmett or Dan Senor.
One thing that I thought was really interesting is that in yesterday's article in the New York Times, there wasn't a note, but in today's article it says Iraqi employees of the New York Times Baghdad bureau contributed reporting from Fallujah for this article and a related one yesterday.
Yeah,
their names aren't even on here.
Yeah, they don't get a byline.
All right, this article was written by Jeffrey Gettleman.
Gettleman.
I mean, bullshit. It seems like it wasn't written by him.
Yeah, no. No, I find it. I mean, I've spoken when I was in Iraq. I spoke to a Washington Post correspondent who I actually thought was quite good, and I think had a very good perspective on the occupation, and has written some very good stories. But these guys do not go out into the field. They have stringers, they have fixers that go out into the field and do interviews for them. And I think that certainly contributes to this perspective, this very close perspective of the reality in Iraq.
Did you have any contact with the newspaper that was shut down this week by the U.S. government?
I did. I actually, when I was working on a story about the Shia, and went to Muqtadar al-Sadr's newspaper and talked to their editor, talked to a couple, you know, employees from the paper. And, you know, I mean, Muqtadar al-Sadr is, I think it's safe to say he's probably out of all the Shia leaders, he's the most staunchly anti-American, the most, I think, basically, you know, the only reason he's got the sort of stature that he does is because of his father, who was killed by Saddam, late 80s. He has some support. He doesn't have as much support as, say, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, or some of the folks in the Hausa party.
What are the communists up to?
I think that a lot of the communist parties are completely out of touch. They're largely people who are in the communist parties in Iraq are largely professionals. They're writers, they're academics.
How big is it?
It used to be huge.
The
Communist Party.
I think the Communist Party in Iraq in the 1950s was probably the largest Communist Party outside of the Soviet Union or Europe.
That's probably true, yeah.
It was very, very strong. There's many different factions who identify as socialists in Iraq, but because of their more or less like professional background in a place that I think has a huge agricultural background, and you know, currently where there's like tremendous unemployment, I think the communist parties, the socialist parties in Iraq are very disconnected from the reality on the ground.
So their presence right now is pretty minuscule.
Yeah, I think the one hope for the Communist Party is that there's an unemployed union, which in the summer of last year and sporadically when I was there would make a presence. They would have, you know, occasional demonstrations and, you know, had some visibility. But I think, you know, they're trying to adapt to the situation. And they honestly, I don't want to diminish, you know, the need for a very sophisticated analysis about identity politics and politics of sexuality and lifestyle and whatever. But in Iraq, I mean, people are unemployed. There's this military occupation, and the one of the communist parties like couldn't speak to that, but you know their manifesto was just loaded with all of these you know opinions on things that seemed irrelevant to a lot of people in Iraq, and I think that that's part of the problem with the communist parties there. They're just not relating with some of the Iraqis.
Getting back to the newspaper that the U.S. government just shut down this week, were you able to form an opinion on that paper when you were over there? Do you think that the reasons that the government gave, you know, saying they were just printing lies or inciting violence, do you think, you know, those were legitimate accusations? And were you, like I said, were you able to form an opinion on the paper?
Yeah, I mean, it was a paper that was, you know, a tabloid in a lot of ways and printed rumors, made grandiose claims about, you know, the Mount Lebanon hotel that was just destroyed by a bomb. Well, it wasn't. I mean, their claim was it wasn't a car bomb. It was a rocket, you know, or it was a missile from, you know, an American aircraft, you know. But the point is that it's, you know, if there's the U.S. administration didn't shut the paper down based on some sort of like question of the paper's credibility. They shut it down because it presented, it reflected, I think, a lot of in a lot of ways, the general attitude towards the occupation. It wasn't inciting anti-American sentiment. It reflected anti-American sentiment. It reflected that there's a lot of rumors on the street. It reflected that whatever America says was the cause of that bombing at the Mount Lebanon Hotel, nobody trusts America. And, you know, was it generating rumors? Was it generating these, like, pie-in-the-sky things that I don't think happened? Yes. Is that the reason to shut down a paper in a country, you know, like Iraq? They're...
Let's have another musical break, and if you want to call and ask questions or comments, please do. It's 415-864-1006, 864-1006. This is Enemy Combatant Radio, and you can listen to us online on enemycombatantradio.net. We're going to play a Johnny Cash song, San Quentin. And then afterwards, it's going to be Tom Waits with Swordfish Trombone.
That was Turkish radio.
And I was thinking about you guys yesterday. Well, I'd been here three times before, and I think I understand a little bit how you feel about some things. It's none of my business how you feel about some other things. And I don't give a damn how you feel about some other things. But anyway, I tried to put myself in your place, and I believe this is the way that I would feel about San Quentin. San Quentin, you've been living hell to me. You blistered me since 1963. I've seen them come and go, and I've seen them die. And long ago I stopped asking why. San Quentin, I hate every inch of you. You cut me and you scarred me through and through. And I'll walk out a wiser, weaker man. Mr. Congressman, you can't understand. What good do you think you do? Do you think I'll be different when you're through? You bend my heart and mind and you warp my soul. Your stone walls turn my blood a little cold. San Quentin, may you rot and burn in hell. May your walls fall and may I live to tell. May all the world forget you ever stood. And may all the world regret.
So you're back with us here on Turkish Delight every Fridays from 5 to 7 with Rob and Liam, and for this week, this is Ali, who's here every week. But maybe our guests will enjoy it so much that they'll decide to come back. So up next, I'm going to play for you the weekly radio report from Sexto Soul. Produced by Sex of Soul, 5 minutes every week. We play this just to get you up to date on what's happening in Mexico.
This is the Mexico Week in Review radio report for the week of March 29, 2004.
This report is a collaboration between Sexto Sol, a Latino issue show airing on Pacifica station KPFT in Houston, Texas, and the Washington, D.C.-based Committee of Indigenous Solidarity.
And now, Teresita Jacinto.
According to the Associated Press, the Zapatistas are stepping up military training. The Zapatista National Liberation Army have erected a dozen new military training camps in the southern state of Chiapas and have almost tripled the number of recruits, the newspaper Reforma reported. The Zapatistas have boosted the number of camps from 8 to 20 and military recruits from an estimated 700 to around 2,000, according to the report. The Zapatistas will not say how many combatants they currently have. The new camps are apparently simply spaces often paved within the Zapatista autonomous indigenous communities that train 100 to 200 fighters apiece. From the highway, Vicente Guerrero appears to be just another dusty farming village, with a particularly breathtaking view of volcanoes. But Vicente Guerrero is much more than an isolated, forgotten community. It is a site of an annual corn festival whose objective is to promote the use and exchange of native corn seeds currently under threat by vast importation of corn from the U.S. The Vicente Guerrero Project for Integral Rural Development celebrated its seventh annual corn festival. Over 300 small farmers and advocates of sustainable development came from all over Central America to celebrate the town's efforts to strengthen campesino, or small farmers, identified through its connection to Mexico's most fundamental product, corn. Rogelio Sanchez Ledesma, coordinator of the Vicente Guerrero Project, worries about the impact of corn imports. "We're going to fall into complete dependence if we don't do something," he claims. Since the implementation of NAFTA in 1994, Mexico has seen corn imports from the U.S. rise to 6 million per year. While this subsidized U.S. corn has caused market prices to fall, this is not the only threat to small farmers in Mexico. Last week, a panel organized by the Commission of Environmental Cooperation, part of a NAFTA side agreement, concluded that genetically modified corn imported from the U.S. threatens the diversity of Mexico's near 60 seed varieties. Vicente Guerrero is taking its own protection measures. "Corn is a form of cultural resistance," claims project member Pablo García Hernández, "and the corn festival represents just that." De La Jornada in Washington, D.C., reportan Jim Kaysen y David Brooks. El demócrata más poderoso del Senado y un colega republicano presentaron hoy un plan de reforma migratorio que ofrece mecanismos más seguros para la legalización de millones de indocumentados que la propuesta del programa de trabajadores temporales del presidente Bush, anunciada a principio de año. El proyecto de ley presentado hoy por el líder de la minoría demócrata del Senado, Tom Daschle, y por el senador republicano Chuck Hagel de Nebraska, probablemente se convertirá en la principal alternativa al plan presentado por Bush. El proyecto considera permitir a los trabajadores indocumentados y sus familias que viven en Estados Unidos obtener la residencia legal si cumplen con una serie de requisitos. Esto incluye haber vivido en Estados Unidos por lo menos 5 años anteriores a la promulgación de la legislación, haber trabajado un mínimo de 3 años y estar al corriente en el pago de impuestos federales. También deberían aprender inglés y pagar una cuota de $1,000. Mientras tanto, Karina Áviles de La Jornada reporta que el presidente del Colegio de la Frontera Norte, COLEF, Jorge Santibáñez Romellón, expresó que es poco realista pensar que se pueda lograr un acuerdo migratorio en lo que resta del sexenio y advirtió que si el presidente Fox realmente cree que la propuesta de trabajadores temporales de George Bush es la solución al problema, entonces realmente estamos perdidos. Santibáñez Romellón señaló que muchos de los migrantes que radican en el vecino país del norte se sentirían muy defraudados si el gobierno mexicano apoya decididamente esta propuesta, porque se centra en el tema de los trabajadores temporales. Por tanto, no es satisfactoria para quienes viven en aquella nación desde hace 10 a 15 años. Manuel García y Griego, de la Universidad de Texas en Arlington, destacó que la de Bush no es una propuesta para resolver el problema de indocumentados, sino de los empresarios, porque Estados Unidos no tiene los suficientes trabajadores locales dispuestos a aceptar empleos con más baja remuneración. De hecho, actualizó, es una iniciativa que busca atraer a un mayor número de trabajadores para que compitan con los indocumentados que ya radican en aquel país. Esta es nuestra palabra. This is our word.
That was the Mexico Week in Review radio report, a service by and for those actively supporting the struggles of the indigenous peoples of Mexico while combating related oppression within their own communities. For information about the Committee of Indigenous Solidarity and its Mexico Week in Review newsletter, send email to cisdc@zzapp.org. For more information on this program, visit www.sextosolradio.org.
That was the weekly radio report from Sexto Sol, uh, K KPF. I always forget the abbreviations. but it's in Texas. It's a public radio station, or Pacifica radio station in Texas that does the weekly report. So we're going to kind of look, we're going to back up a little and look at a bigger picture and look at the motivations for the war and the motivations for creating this situation, this incredibly unstable situation in Iraq. So any speculators, any takers, any revealers?
Well, you know, I would say one thing that the anti-war movement, the peace movement, whatever you want to call it, can be happy about is we can all step back and say, you know what, we were absolutely right. This war was not about weapons of mass destruction. It was not about bringing democracy to Iraq. It was about geopolitics. It was about controlling the Middle East. And even Jay Garner, who was the ousted, the initial administrator of Iraq in the post-war period, who was pulled by George Bush and Don Rumsfeld and replaced by Paul Bremer, even he said to an interview with Greg Palast, said, you know what? What this war was about setting up bases in the Middle East which could replace the bases in Saudi Arabia, which the U.S. wants to get out of. It's the Philippines all over. It's about, and that was his words, I mean, it's about setting up these military bases a la Philippines that the U.S. can use as a center for policing the region. And again, the peace movement, the anti-war movement was right in a way in that it's about oil. It's not about oil profits. It's not about, oh, we're addicted to automobiles. It's about controlling oil resources. And the U.S. is not heavily dependent on Middle East oil or Iraqi oil. The EU...
Do you think it's going to become more and more dependent?
Not necessarily, no. I think it's about controlling oil resources that the two other poles of global power, the European Union and Asia, are highly dependent on. And both those poles are highly dependent on Iraqi oil, whereas the U.S. gets a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia, from Venezuela. So I think it's about geopolitics and about establishing centers of operation for policing that area.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we can sit back and go, hey, we're right, we're now challenged with...
It sounds like we have a caller, but the phone is actually outside the studio, but somebody is about to pick it up, and if they'll ask to see if you're if you want to be on air or not. It's still ringing. Let me see, one second. Hello.
Hey, I had a question for Rob, but I can wait and listen to him talk first.
Do you want to take this question now, Rob?
No, I'll listen to him talk first.
All right.
No, I forgot what it was. Go ahead with the question. I forgot. Got sidetracked.
All right, we can take your question now.
Yeah, it was about some polls that have been taken that, let's see, I think it was BBC and ABC said that a majority of Iraqis they talked to wanted the U.S. to stay, or said that the ouster of Saddam Hussein was a good thing. And I recently read an article about that on the Dissident Voice website by a woman named Sharon Smith, who said that she feels that one of the reasons the results were skewed that way was that the Iraqis that these people talked to, like the BBC people, were concerned about speaking to Westerners and offering their honest opinions and stuff. And I wanted to see what if Rob had an opinion on that.
No,
and that whole dynamic and this question of like a lot of Iraqis supposedly wanting the U.S. to stay and thinking it was still a good thing that the U.S. forced out Saddam.
Well, I think after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and there was massive amounts of looting, people, I think many people I spoke to did feel like the U.S. had a role in post-war Iraq, mm-hmm. that people wanted them to stay and provide security. People wanted them to help stabilize a country where there was this immense political vacuum that was created after Saddam was deposed.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Americans haven't been able to even do that. They haven't been able to stabilize the country. They haven't been able to ensure that people have basic needs such as electricity, drinkable water, jobs. They haven't been able to control the security. So I think that many, you know, I agree that probably you ask a lot of Iraqis and they say, yeah, the role, there is a role for the Americans, but they've completely failed at that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's now a distrust and a real repulsion amongst Iraqis for the Americans America's presence. I think just one last thing is, I think you have to look at the effect that a Western journalist has. The fact that somebody's a Western journalist, that has an effect on people's answers.
Mm-hmm.
I think when there's a bunch of photographers in Fallujah, when these bodies have been maimed or these dead bodies are being sort of paraded around, I mean, people act up to the
like
camera.
Yeah, like 10 kids dancing in Palestine after the bombing of the World Trade Center.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a corollary question, which is about the UN role. You know, almost never, even Robert Collier in American Prospect, who's a pretty good reporter, he had a 4-page story about the occupation and the role of the UN, the word sanctions never appeared.
Right.
And so I wonder a lot about the way Iraqis look at the UN and the role that the UN could play or should play. And because you hear a lot of liberals in the U.S. saying, well, you know, we should let the UN take over. But apparently these people have a historical memory of about a couple of months or something because...
Right.
Or they never heard about the sanctions on Iraq.
Right. Well, liberal Americans have a very short memory, like you say. They seem to forget that the UN imposed 12 years of sanctions in Iraq,
exactly.
Which led to, you know, 500,000 Iraqi children being killed.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, and that wasn't just the UN. I mean, the UN really is, I think, in many ways, or in certain circumstances, very much carries out the will of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly under Clinton, Clinton was much better at manipulating the UN as this quote-unquote humanitarian face to, like, a very imperialist project. Bush, I mean, I like Bush for the very simple fact that he's very honest. I mean, it's an imperialist project, and he's going to go it alone. Whereas, like, I think actually Clinton would have done a much, much better job post 9/11 than Bush did, but that's another story.
But how do you feel about people in the attitude of people in Iraq towards the UN? Do you think they feel that it's there are different dynamics now with the UN and compared to the U.S. troops? Maybe it'll be better.
Well, I think, you know, people in Iraq definitely see the UN as an agent of severe repression in terms of the sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the UN did a very strategically good thing in their interest in coming in and investigating the likelihood of elections. And the UN took a very, like, shrewd political position, which was, on one hand, they said to Sistani and the Shia population who were demanding direct elections in June that it just wasn't possible. But what didn't get reported on as widely was that the UN said the US's plan for regional caucuses was completely unacceptable. The UN, I think, more or less saved its harshest words for the U.S., and I think because of that, the UN is trying to establish itself as, like, an independent international presence again.
Another reason why I think that the Iraqis are very apprehensive to the United Nations, apart from the sanctions, is actually the inspections. Like, the inspections went on for some, I believe, seven or 8 years after the end of the first Gulf War, and these inspections were, I mean, regardless of how they were, and they were incredibly intrusive and all over Iraq with a huge team, were seen by the Iraqis as basically a threat to their sovereignty, you know?
Right.
Who are you to come and look at our inspections when you are practically a puppet of a country, and Israel is also of these countries? This is basically, I think, the Iraqi psyche.
Right.
If you are a puppet, and you are proving this by imposing these certain resolutions and not imposing certain other resolutions, and these countries have the greatest stockpiles of nuclear weapons in the world, and
right.
you're coming and intruding our space. I think that that's also a reason why the UN is truly hated in Iraq.
Yeah, well, I think there's two things. I mean, one is Scott Ritter, the former head of UNSCOM, basically resigned, saying, look, I was acting as an agent of U.S. intelligence. I mean, they were basically monitoring where I was going, and, you know, he was basically an agent of U.S. intelligence, and he quit. This wasn't about disarming in Iraq. It was about collecting hard data on where, you know, Saddam's movements, palaces that he was at, scientists. And so he said, this isn't about monitoring and trying to disarm Iraq. This is about American intelligence. And, you know, what the other point you're bringing up, Ali, is everybody knows throughout the Middle East, you know, well, who's the only power in the Middle East that has nuclear and chemical weapons? You know, not chemical weapons, but nuclear weapons is Israel.
And,
you know,
also,
and they refuse to admit it.
I just want to say, when you mentioned Scott Ritter, when Scott Ritter goes around talking, he shows this video that he made called Shifting Sands. And I think that the most revealing part of the documentary is this interaction that he recounts with his superior, Richard Butler. His last name is definitely
mm-hmm.
Butler, but it was right at the transition of UNSCOM to Unimovic. And that during that transition, he says, this was at the peak of the Levinsky scandal, of the Monica
mm-hmm.
Levinsky scandal, right before Desert Fox. I think it was 98, I believe, when they did Desert Fox during Clinton. And he said that his superior told him to create a conflict on a certain day so they could start bombing
mm-hmm.
a week later.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the fact that they're using this terrain as a way to manipulate their own political goals in this country,
mm-hmm.
you know, the bombing of the Desert Fox during the whole Levinsky scandal,
I mean, maybe we're digressing here, but I think one of the best movies that I've seen recently is The Tailor of Panama.
It's a great movie.
It's a great film. I mean, it really illustrates. I mean, here's like Pierce Brosnan as a MI6 agent who shows up in Panama after being kicked out of another country where he slept with the ambassador's mistress or something, right? So he ends up in Panama, where basically everything's hunky-dory after the U.S. goes in and, like, on one level, ouse a ruler, Noriega, who they had a falling out with, but at the same time bombs neighborhoods in Panama where essentially, like, There was a burgeoning student and underground movement. So he goes into Panama, Pierce Brosnan's character, and essentially, with the work of this other British exile, fabricates an uprising that's going to happen, right? And also, like, fabricates the fact that the Panamanian government, which has just gotten control of the Panama Canal, is going to sell it to, like, China, right? So, and at the same time, Pierce Brosnan's, like, basically spoofing James Bond.
He's the real James Bond.
Right. So, I mean, this was like this Hollywood movie that I think was, like, in a very brilliant and creative way. But I don't want to say brilliant and creative. I mean, it was a good flick. But, I mean, it showed sort of the machinations at work of that war is the health of the state,
uh-huh.
right? Without conflict, without, you know, the potential for a threat, the state is undermined. And Israel is the best example of this. If there was not a Palestinian threat, if Palestinians were given the right of return, if Palestinians were given a state in the West Bank and Gaza, what would happen to Israel? The need for an economy that supports almost solely only the military. There's almost like, even more so than the United States, I think, it runs like a huge domestic deficit. It's a military state. And without this threat from like the Arab world, which is going to supposedly push it into the sea, you know, the Israeli state, the need for this militaristic state goes away.
Getting back to Iraq, how high is the awareness of the Iraqi people that you...
Let's see. Ben, do you have any other questions?
No, that's good. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for calling. Bye.
I'm just curious as to how aware the Iraqi people are of the upcoming presidential election, and, you know, if you notice anything about that, like, do they have, you know, do the Iraqi people know about John Kerry? Do they favor him over Bush, you know, or are they just...
Well, I think, you know, as one of your colleagues at The Guardian put it, I think Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi resistance are really the third party in the American elections. And I think we can almost guarantee... I don't want to say almost guaranteed, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if some domestic action, terrorist action in the United States, and I can certainly almost guarantee that there'll be some spike in resistance in Iraq prior to the elections. I think people in Iraq are very aware of the political situation in America.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up. If you need help, hang up.
All right.
Don't you think it would you know, possibly backfire if there was some kind of domestic terrorist action in America right before the elections, you know, seeing as how Bush is usually viewed as the one who is tougher on terrorism, and American people might see that as a reason to, you know, vote Bush back into office, thinking that he's going to have, like, a swifter, more brutal, you know, violent, authoritarian response, you know?
I think that depends on a lot of things. I mean, I don't know that... I'm comfortable speculating on all these right. different situations, but I think, you know, certainly Spain showed, I mean, the difference in Spain was there was a tremendous opposition to Aznar's support for the invasion in Iraq. You know, massive demonstrations in March of last year, upwards of 90% of those polled in Spain saying they were opposed to the, you know, Spain participating in this quote unquote coalition of the willing. Obviously, that's not the case in America, but I think given the ever-increasing number of American soldiers that have been killed, the fact that a lot of the National Guard and Army troops that have been in Iraq are now transitioning out, we're going to get more stories from soldiers coming back from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, maybe is the time that we're going to start, you know, maybe we're entering a very critical period. In terms of a critical look at the war in Iraq. Because all the arguments, like I said before, the peace movement's been right, almost, you know, without exception, about the war in Iraq. And I think all the arguments that the administration used have been exposed. We're going to get soldiers fresh back from Iraq. We're going to see more and more soldiers killed. It's going to become more and more costly. I think the only reason that this war continues is there's a lack of opposition. I mean, let's face it, John Kerry, the Democrats are irrelevant.
All right. Well, we're going to start to close the show. I'm going to give you announcements of two events happening. One is actually going to go on in a little more than an hour at ATA. That's Artist Television Access. It's on between 20th and 21st on Valencia Street. It's a screening of Panama Deception. Benefiting Whispered Media. If you haven't seen The Panama Deception, you should definitely see it. It's one of the, I think, more enlightening documentaries out there. And the next announcement I want to give you is Howard Zinn's play Marx in Soho, which is going to be performed at UC Berkeley Dwinnell Hall at sometime during the day tomorrow in the socials conference between, it's going to happen between 10 and 7 is when the conference is happening. And it's $10 for the performance. And there's also going to be another performance of Marx in Soho on Sunday, April 4th at 6 p.m. at Haymarket Books Library, which is on 110th Cap Street. So I recommend this play, by the way. I think it's a very good one. So thanks for being on the show, guys.
Rob, thanks, Ali.
Thank you.
We had two guests this weekend. We'll have more next week. I'm going to close the show with Hey from the Pixies from the CD Doolittle.
trying to meet you.